Hello and welcome to Physics Frontiers number 33, Retrocausality. Show notes can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/33. And if you'd like to read along, the notes include links to the papers discussed in this program.
Hey Randy, what's going on?
Good evening, James.
What would you like to talk about today, Randy?
Well, this is a subject which you got us started on, I think, quite a while ago when we started doing the Quantum Paradoxes book by Yakir Akhuranov. We were working towards this concept, and there's some really terrific papers that you provided here that seem to make a really excellent argument for retrocausality.
So these are some papers that are talking about whether or not what happens in the future influences what happened in the past in quantum mechanics. I don't think the way they're talking about that, I'd want to say it that way. When we're talking about what Akhuranov was doing in Quantum Paradoxes, I think it makes sense to talk about it that way, because eventually he's going to talk about waves coming backwards in time and things having to match up and stuff like that. In this case, mostly what they're doing is they're trying to talk about what's happening in space-time, basically like harmonics, right? Like harmonics on a string or something like that.
Yeah, the Hamiltonian.
Yeah, well, they're talking about the Hamiltonian and the interpretation of the wave function, and they want the wave function to be something like a standing wave in time, if that makes any sense. So that, you know, if you set a detector this way and you set a detector that way, what happens in between is based on those two possible states, right? Not only on what you set for the original detector or for your initial preparation of your system.
Yeah, it's pretty heady stuff, though, because you're talking about, you know, the future being a boundary condition on something which is happening now.
So it's a little bit weird, but the thing I've always liked about this kind of interpretation, it's more or less a meta-interpretation of quantum mechanics. We'll find that out when we talk about what Hugh Price and Ken Wharton were talking about in their papers. So it's sort of a meta-interpretation of quantum mechanics that is sort of consistent with the Bloch universe model in special relativity and general relativity. And that's sort of what's nice about it. It just doesn't sort of meet our perceptions, but our perception of time may be completely thermodynamical. We've talked about that a little bit before. There are different places where we can have an arrow of time, and it's likely that the only reason why we perceive time the way we perceive time is thermodynamics. Now, the big question is the arrow of time of thermodynamics set completely due to statistics, in which case you could have a varying thermodynamic arrow of time in different places and different times in the universe? Or is that based on something deeper in quantum mechanics? Is there a irreversibility in quantum mechanics that's not the projection postulate? So if you take the rest of quantum mechanics, then you have a reversible system, except for what they call a measurement in quantum mechanics. At that point, things become irreversible, but that's sort of an add-on to quantum mechanics. That's something that's in there to let us make sense of the measurements.
Can you tell me a little bit about the projection postulate? That came up a couple times in these papers, but they didn't really get into it.
The projection postulate is just saying that when you make a measurement, usually I say when you make a measurement, but I'm not really sure what counts as a measurement in quantum mechanics. Is it when you physically make a measurement? The whole Schrodinger's cat thing is the problem. Where does the wave function make a decision about whether or not something happened this way or that way? And the projection postulate says when you make a measurement, your measurement has to be in what's called an eigenstate of the system. It's got to be in a characteristic state of the system you're looking at. So if you're looking at an electron, if you're looking at the spin of an electron in a Stern-Gerlach experiment, then when you make your measurement, the electron has to decide whether or not its spin is aligned or anti-aligned with that magnetic field gradient. And it will. It chooses either to go up one direction or go down another direction. Now, the thing is it's made that decision because you can now put a detector there. You can actually take a picture of it. I've got one of those up on YouTube somewhere. So you can look at that thing and you can see that the electron made a choice. It's either pointed one way or another, or at least the wave function has stopped having a probability of going one way or the other. And it's now in one state or the other because you've just forced it to go that direction.
Right. This is all within the context of the Copenhagen interpretation, right, where the wave function remains in a superposition until there's a measurement, and then it has to come up with a finite number. But I think what we're looking at here with these retrocausality papers seems to be an alternative interpretation that restores realism. Isn't that right?
Well, Price is talking about this in what I think of as a philosophical realist standpoint. That is to say that when he's saying realism, what he's saying is that that wave function is a real thing. Whatever that wave function is, it's a real thing. He doesn't say what it is. He just says, if we're going to say that the wave function's a real thing rather than just a useful tool for calculating the results of experiments, which is kind of that Copenhagen interpretation, then you're going to have this and this and this and this. That does not mean the wave function is always in a particular state. What it does mean is that the wave function between the two detectors is going to have to be coherent with those two detectors. So you made a decision here, you made a decision here. When you have something coming in and something coming out, the wave function has to be in the right state at the ends, but it doesn't necessarily have to be in one of those two states in between. What that would mean is that when you make your preparation, you more or less have an eigenstate. When you make your measurement, you have an eigenstate. And what happens with what's going on in the wave function, it has to end up in those eigenstates, but it doesn't necessarily have to have that value in the middle. You still can't really talk about what happens in the middle until you know what is in the middle. So if you make an assumption, like the de Broglie-Bohm hypothesis, if you make that sort of assumption, then you can start talking about what's going on with the different things in the different places. So you could say, all right, I've got this fluid. The fluid's going to have a standing wave in time, basically. And then the little particle is going to hop through that standing wave. I think they actually talked about that. That's how you'd have to interpret de Broglie-Bohm based on their results, their philosophical interpretation.
It seemed like Ken Wharton in the Time Symmetric Boundary Conditions and Quantum Foundations paper. Seems like he was taking it to a whole new level, though, where he was deriving a quantum phenomena using classical fields within the context of the initial boundary condition and the final boundary condition.
Yeah, that was very nice. So basically with that, what he was saying is that the Schrodinger equation just doesn't have enough information in it, because it's only got one time derivative. So it's a wave equation with only one time derivative. It doesn't have enough information to fully determine what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah, and it was fascinating that it seems that if you use the initial boundary condition, then you only have half the information necessary. That's where you end up with these quantum seemingly mysteries. But if you use the final boundary condition, then you can have the full set of information that you need in order to work through the whole evolution, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what he was doing. He was trying to make something work in that situation. So he was saying that the Schrödinger equation is this first order differential equation, but the Klein-Gordon equation, which is a relativistic equivalent, is second order in time. And that doesn't run into the same problems.
That's fascinating to me.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense, because a lot of the problems when you're interpreting quantum mechanics, when you get into all these strange ideas about what's happening, occur just because you've decided you want to try to interpret what's happening simultaneously in two different spots in the universe. So you're completely ignoring special relativity most of the time when you're arguing about what is the right way to interpret quantum mechanics, what is the right interpretation of this wave function, what is the right interpretation of the projection postulate, what is the real meaning of measurement in quantum mechanics. So it makes a lot of sense that a relativistic equation doesn't have all of the issues that the Schrodinger equation does. And an interpretation of the Schrodinger equation that makes sense should have the same information available to it that the relativistic one does. And of course, the way he gets this information is to put a final boundary condition on the wave, just like you have an initial boundary condition on the wave. Just like if you have a sound wave, for example, on either side of your clarinet, you have a boundary condition. That's more or less what he's talking about, only he's, instead of doing that through a tube, he's talking about doing that in time for a quantum mechanical particle.
You know, this seems to suggest that there should be some kind of way to experiment with this, right? I mean, is there any way to confirm this or test this idea?
Well, I don't know that there is. So what all of these papers put together are trying to do, they're trying to make sense Bell's theorem, right? Which we've talked about before. It has to do with correlations that just don't work the way you want them to in quantum mechanics.
Yeah, I guess we should probably mention quickly, you know, that quantum entanglement is kind of a bedrock concept in these discussions, because the conventional interpretation with quantum entanglement is that You have two entangled particles that head out in opposite directions, so they're not in each other's light cone, and you measure an aspect of one particle, say the polarization, and then that alters the probability on the other side of the polarization that you're going to measure. So it seems like they communicate faster than the speed of light, or spooky action at distance, what have you. And this idea with retrocausality allows the future measurement to condition the particle all the way through from the moment it's entangled to the future measurement point. So it has an influence backwards in time, in a sense, in that it alters the probabilities in a totally real way, that they don't exist in a superposition, that they're actually aware of the measurement happening in the future before you take the measurement, in a sense. And so instead of being confronted with a problem of this non-locality, which is really troubling, the idea of action at a distance freaked out Einstein, this gives you a mechanism of looking at it from a time symmetry standpoint, so that it's all connected through special relativity, and there's no longer this weird paradox where quantum mechanics seems to have this non-special relativistic property, right?
Yeah, it's something very much like that. So when Bell put out his theorem, he was saying that either you have real probabilities, objects or correlations that act like regular probabilities for regular objects, or you have what happens with these wave functions. When he did that, he made a couple of simple assumptions. One of those was that everything was causal, and one of those was that everything was local. If everything's causal and everything's local, then you have normal probability influences, normal correlations, you know, basically perpendicular experiments would be uncorrelated. Parallel experiments would be 100% correlated, and something at 45 degrees would be 50% correlated.
Which is what we see with, like, classical physics, right?
And that would be classical physics. But in quantum mechanics, when we put things at that 45-degree angle, things are, like, 70% correlated. And so you end up with an issue, because that can't happen in classical physics. It's absolutely required in quantum physics. You do your experiments, and these experiments are fairly tricky to do. It took Aspect quite a while to make the first of those. You do those experiments. You do them with photons. You can do them with electrons. It doesn't matter. They all end up doing the quantum mechanical thing. So that means one of the two assumptions that Bell made is wrong. Either you have non-local action at a distance, either you have something that looks a little bit like communication between things that are far away, or
sacrifice causality, huh?
Or you sacrifice causality in some sense. And according to this, if you decide that you want to sacrifice causality by letting the end of the path of a particle influence the beginning of the path of the particle, then you can have all of these correlations without sacrificing locality.
So that's where the retrocausality comes in, because with retrocausality, it will actually predict these violations of Bell's equality. Man, that's fascinating.
And it's a little bit better. It's a little bit better, because at least in this case, you don't have a problem with simultaneity. So if you have these correlations at very different distances, now you have to start worrying about what it means to make a simultaneous measurement on that particle. As the distances get greater and greater, people are going to disagree more and more about what is and is not simultaneous. But that's not true if the simultaneity doesn't matter, if what really matters is the path length in spacetime.
Yeah, and since QED works so well and special relativity is such a pillar, a central pillar of all physics, you really want to preserve that within quantum mechanics.
Well, you know, quantum electrodynamics is perfectly compatible with special relativity. And again, I think a lot of the problems come about because we're trying to look at this special case in quantum mechanics, which is when things are going very, very slowly, which is where we do a lot of things in classical physics as well, which is where classical physics is, right? But I don't think you have the same problems with quantum electrodynamics. I mean, usually people aren't interpreting quantum electrodynamics, they're interpreting what's going on in regular quantum mechanics, non-relativistic quantum mechanics, and I don't know that you have the same issues. You probably have other issues. I don't know what they are, but QED is weird enough that it's probably easier to have your issues with quantum mechanics because it's not as weird as QED. Well, I mean, if you look at QED, it's all Lagrangian-based, and that's basically what we're talking about in this case, is that you have some situation where you're taking the Lagrangian seriously rather than the Hamiltonian. But the problem with the Lagrangian is when you're looking at the Lagrangian, what you're looking at is a variational principle. And that variational principle, it's this weird idea where you say, okay, I know the starting point, I know the ending point. Now, how would something have gotten from this spot to that spot? And so you calculate this Lagrangian, which is basically the kinetic energy minus the potential energy. So you have this number, and then you just say, well, I'm going to integrate over this path, and I'm going to do a little bit of mathematical magic so that I can vary my path in between and find the path where you have the minimum something, in this case, the minimum action. And when you get that minimum action, when you get that minimal path, that's more or less the path nature takes. Now, if you try to interpret that realistically, in that philosophically realistic manner, how is anything varying? How does the path vary? Is it just mathematical magic? Right? I don't know. Would a second time do something like that? I don't know. And then, of course, you have to think about the stuff like, oh, how would I perceive that? Well, I wouldn't perceive that. I would always be this guy that's changing just a little bit. There might be in that variation just a little pocket where I exist. But then all of the possibilities that are real possibilities in my life would actually occur. But it would only be a tiny little pocket, even though it was an infinite number of possibilities. It would be a very small infinity.
A very small infinity.
Well, it would still be a continuous infinity. It'd still be at least Aleph 1, but it would have a very small area compared to the total number of possibilities for the number of universes that would be possible. You know, that you have to interpret that Lagrangian if you want to interpret quantum electrodynamics in a realistic way. And that includes all of these strange things, which are things that people calculate, which are, you know, every single possibility that a particle breaks into two and comes back into itself, or breaks into two, and then that breaks into two, and that breaks into two, and then all of a sudden, all the combinations that bring it back to itself and stuff like that. You have to somehow interpret all of those things. And I don't know how philosophy people interpret those things, because apparently everybody's more interested in talking about this approximation to that more accurate theory. And I'm not sure why.
One of the things that I loved about these papers, and there was a second paper that we read called The New Slant on the EPR Bell Experiment, and that was also co-authored by Ken Wharton. And I had never seen this before, so I was kind of stunned to see it. It was the way that there is a rotational analog between the EPR Bell experiments and this single photon split beam experiment. So the separation was in time instead of in space. And he showed how intuitive it is that you get the exact same probability distribution in that experiment where you're just bouncing a photon off of a mirror into another split beam detector, and how that was analogous to if you rotate it sort of 90 degrees through space-time and you get the entangled particles moving to two different split beam experiments simultaneously. And how he showed that if you use retrocausality, that you can explain them both sort of with the same mathematical model and demystify them completely.
Yeah, that was very interesting. I'm not sure how convincing it is in general, but I mean, as far as what it goes like, I mean, it's really amazing that you get the same correlate. I mean, it's the same math, right?
Right. It's the same math, but rotated 90 degrees, so you get a space-like instead of a time-like interval. It's kind of, I just never even seen anybody look at it that way, and it's a very elegant model, you know?
That's probably how Bell got the idea. You know, he had to get the idea from somewhere, and this is sort of like some of the things we've talked about in the past with the Stern-Gerlach experiment. So with the Stern-Gerlach experiment, you get actually the same factor that Wharton is talking about when you put these things at an angle, right? It's the same cosine squared of the angle between the detectors. The only difference is that this is with photons and polarizations. So this is, I mean, this is very interesting. And what's interesting to me, at least, is that in that second experiment that he was talking about, in the time-like experiment, you just have a mirror. You basically have a laser coming in, then you have a polarizer, then you have a mirror, and then you have another polarizer. And after it goes through that other polarizer, you make a measurement, and then you figure out what the correlations are between the two polarizers, which is actually fairly easy because you can just measure the intensity in that case because it's all one light beam. Well, what takes the place of that mirror in the EPR paradox, in this sort of aspect-like experiment? I mean, it's a two-photon decay. It's a 2s to 1s transition in hydrogen. And so that's interesting, and it's interesting that you can end up with these similar correlations. I think it's interesting to talk about how they use those correlations in a second, but I think a lot of people are going to not care too much about this analogy just because of the very different nature of those two central events. And I don't think, as I recall, that he did anything that showed this mathematically. I don't think it's much of an issue to me. I think it's an interesting analogy, but I don't think it's going to convince somebody who doesn't want to be convinced.
From a special relativistic standpoint, though, it looks really compelling because it seems like kind of an equivalent, like with the Poulenc-Baron paradox and things like that. You see that when you basically rotate the laws of physics by changing the velocity in the way you're observing it from one reference frame to the next, the correlations are just a simple rotation between different reference frame perceiving the same events. So mathematically, that formula for the action seems to be following that exact same kind of model, you know? Like, it's a perfectly reasonable argument from the standpoint of special relativity, right?
I think it's more than a perfectly reasonable argument in terms of special relativity. I think it's it might even be sublime if you're looking at it relativistically, because, yes, I think that if you're looking at it in terms of the Bloch universe, there shouldn't be much of a difference. If you're committed to saying there's nothing special about time, then there shouldn't be a difference in your interpretation. But I don't think everybody is convinced that there's nothing special about time.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of people like to debate that subject, but boy, you know, the physics seems so clear that special relativity does show the perfect equivalence between time and, well, velocity, really. Makes me wonder if there's any kind of spatial analogy for the second law of thermodynamics, which is where I guess everybody gets hung up on. It's because we have this preferred direction of time, but we don't have a preferred direction of space. And I wonder if there's some way to simulate that direction for entropy using a space-like system instead of a time-like one, you know?
We might think about it just in terms of diffusion. But if you can think about it in terms of diffusion, there is a tendency for things to go from a denser to a less dense region, and it's completely statistical. And that's more or less what you can think of time being in terms of entropy. I'm trying to think. If you're made up of the same material, then if you have a less dense region, it has less entropy, so it's going in the wrong direction.
Doesn't time have the opposite sign in special relativity from space anyway, so wouldn't that make sense?
Maybe. Don't know.
Okay. The fact that Wharton was able to take classical fields and use this model, boy, Fetzer or something like that?
Speckens.
That's right. So that was amazing. Like, he basically was able to show that classical fields can emulate quantum fields if you don't have the complete information set. But he was only postulating that the missing information, which in his example he was interpreting as hidden variables that were random and unknowable, but Wharton points out that they weren't looking at the possibility that the hidden variables were actually information from the future of that own system interacting with its own initial conditions also, right? And so that actually does predict Bell's inequality violations. It explains the delayed choice style of experiments that we've seen, like the delayed choice quantum eraser experiment. Like, all of these are trivial if you accept this concept that, I guess, in very special conditions where entropy doesn't play a role, where you don't have defined era of time, like these quantum experiments that we're talking about, that you can get the exact results that these experiments are showing without doing anything exotic beyond that. You know, there's no non-locality, there's no mystery to it. So what I ask is, you're saying that Aharonov took this idea and he went even further with it?
Well, I mean, he did a different sort of thing with it. And they talk about these in some of these papers. And that's what he was building up to with the Quantum Paradoxes book, was his own interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is what that second half of the book that we never finished is. So the first half is building up what quantum mechanics is using the paradoxes. And then he uses more and more complex and interesting paradoxes to say that you have to have some sort of backwards causality. And in his case, he has sort of a wave coming back. It's got sort of a reflected wave that has to, I'm not sure if it's a reflected wave, it's been a while, but he has a wave coming backwards that meets the one going forwards and they have to sort of reconcile. So apparently there are issues with that in curved space-time. So, and Wharton was talking about this in his time-symmetric boundary conditions and quantum foundations paper, that this 1964 interpretation by Aharonov and Vaidman, this two-state formalism, basically does the same thing that the final boundary conditions does by doubling the size of the quantum state, by having that forward quantum state and the backward quantum state at the same time. But that has a problem when it gets into curved space-time.
But that's not an intrinsic problem in this interpretation that Wharton's looking at, right? Because he was talking about how by setting the initial and final boundary conditions and just defining that hypersurface, I guess that helps you understand the complete Hamiltonian, that you could integrate that with general relativity better, right?
Yeah, he's saying that that's compatible with general relativity, because in this case, you just have initial conditions and final conditions, and the space in between can do whatever it wants. You don't have to worry about some of the issues that aren't talked about in this particular paper.
He made a statement in this paper at the end that really set me back on my heels. He said the statement is, "It is even possible that instead of quantizing space-time, an approach to quantum gravity might be found in the continuous ontology of classical field theory." Wow! Because I've seen some of the pretty amazing work that quantum gravity physicists have been doing in terms of quantizing space-time. But if he's right here, then we may see the light at the end of the tunnel for a classical field theory of quantum mechanics that can bring it home to classical theory of general relativity, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you can interpret this in a mathematical way, that's they can also have gravity as a limit, they can have general relativity as a limit, then possibly you can do something like that. But, you know, that sounds pretty tough. Even, you know, these are very interesting papers, but they're not, say, super predictive.
Yeah, they seem like they're sort of conceptual beginnings. But these worked about 8 years ago. Did you see anything being developed over the last 8 years that might have taken these ideas further?
I know there's additional controversy and stuff like that. People are still talking about them. To be honest, I think the first one of these that I saw was the one that we got rid of, right? The one that was from 2017, I think. And that one was by some other guys, and I just happened to notice a couple of names I knew, Wharton and Price. So I looked up those papers, and I thought these were much better than that 2017 paper, whatever it was that I saw. So that's why we're talking about these. I don't know that I saw anything that seemed to me be more...
Big leaps forward, huh?
Yeah, there wasn't any real progress. I don't know how much there is, because a lot of this is really interpretations of what you're seeing rather than a real theory, just like all those quantum interpretations, just like the de Broglie-Bohm hypothesis. It's interesting. It seems to make a lot of sense in a pretty real way, but it doesn't really give you anything new that you can test. Same thing here. Even better, for the most part, what these papers are talking about, and especially the other two, are limits on interpretations or interpretations of interpretations. So like I was saying, a sort of meta-interpretation, this is how you have to interpret things if you have this issue or if you try to interpret this issue in this way. And it says some things that just make a lot of sense, right? Like, according to these things, the De Broglie-Bohm hypothesis will require at some point this retrocausality. It's sort of necessary based on what's going on. That's not true for other interpretations. It said the multiple world interpretation where there's no collapse because we're all stuck in particular wave function. Each universe is just what happens at each particular spot whenever something actually makes a decision sort of thing. There's no big deal for that guy because that guy doesn't say anything. So you have these different interpretations of the interpretations, what at least they claim has to be true for different interpretations based on what's going on in these EPR Bell experiments and this sort of slanted or sideways EPR Bell experiment.
Yeah, I really like that one. Do you know if Bohm looked at this retrocausality issue?
No, I don't know. I don't know how much it would interest him.
Well, as I understand it, his model has trouble with entanglement and these very specific phenomena that the retrocausality seems to explain.
I mean, you have to remember that Bohm did a couple of things. One is he was the first person to make a clear exposition of the EPR paradox. And that's what Bell used to make his theorem, is Bohm's reformulation of the EPR paradox, because the original one, as we talked about in Physics FM podcast, was pretty convoluted. He did that, and he also produced this interpretation. And this interpretation was just to show that by splitting up the wave function into two bits, you could create something that would produce the right kind of results. So those are the things he'd looked at. I'm not sure how much he'd pushed into special relativity because, I mean, it took, what, 20 years, 25 years for somebody to actually make the experiments after he originally formulated the thing? So it took a very, very long time. I'm not sure if it made too much of a difference to him because, you know, the way he'd formulated it, it was just to kind of show a certain idea was possible. Now, to be fair, according to this, only one of those two parts of the Bohmian interpretation has to be subject to the initial and final boundary conditions. Both of them don't have to. It seems to me that only one of them has to, from my reading. I don't think Bohm has to worry too much about this. I think it just makes Bohm make more sense. It's actually one of the reasons why I like something like the Bohm interpretation, is that you have these initial and final boundary conditions. Personally, the initial final boundary conditions is something that I like very much. I don't know where I first heard the idea. I do remember when I was in my 20s actually liking this kind of interpretation of quantum mechanics. I don't know if I read it somewhere. I don't know if I just thought it made more sense or something like that. But I really don't remember where I first heard about it. But it's something that I do remember when I was an undergraduate thinking was a really good idea.
Well, I think that there's a lot of appeal in the block universe idea that physicists naturally embrace. The idea that the universe is complete as in time, you know, that it's all one unit. The future already exists in some tangible sense. And this idea fits in hand in glove with that. Plus, it answers all these wonderful mysteries. One of the remarks that Wharton made, there was a couple of remarks in that paper that he made that kind of baffled me. Not that I think they're wrong, but I didn't necessarily see the steps in logic. Before I mention that, apparently he's saying in this paper that by adding the final boundary conditions to the initial boundary conditions, that you end up quantization of angular momentum in units of h-bar over 2. So he's basically showing that the Heisenberg uncertainty principle falls out of this model through a totally classical mechanism, right?
Yes.
Wow. I mean, that's just, I'd never thought that would even be possible, because that's often cited as the reason why quantum mechanics can't be classical, and here he's saying, here it is.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you get something similar in optics, right? I mean, if you look at a...
In cavities, right.
I don't think it's that strange. As long as you've got this sort of wave nature somewhere.
Right.
You're going to have something like that. And especially if you're going to have the initial final boundary conditions, you're going to have something like that.
Yeah, well, yeah, it makes sense now that I've read it, but I just didn't see it coming, you know.
You know, it's all in Goldstein. I mean, when you're taking your graduate mechanics class, it's in the book. I don't know if you'll usually get to that part of the book because it's way at the end, but I mean, it's there.
Okay, yeah, I never saw that. There was a statement in here that really did kind of twist my melon. He said that, as above, this implies that our assumed freedom, when and where we can make measurements, maybe illusory, but he didn't really seem to support that with any development.
I'm not sure exactly what he says, but I mean, it may be illusory to within, you know, delta x delta p is greater than or equal to h bar over 2, right?
Right, some ridiculously tiny degree.
It might not be something that we can actually detect, although, I mean, that might be an interesting thing to try to detect, if you can. I don't know how you would.
Yeah, he was referring at one point to the need to take measurements at sub-attosecond scales in order to detect the ramifications, the physical ramifications of this concept. And aren't we getting there? I mean, I think that we're starting, there's like really very shortly brief pulse laser experiments going on at that scale now, isn't there?
Yeah, I don't know what the technical issues are, but if things keep going the way they're going, it's going to be something they can do. I mean, Wharton is a laser physicist.
Right, so he would know all about that. Well, maybe he'll be the one to publish that paper. Well, you know, any theory that can explain, like, all the quantum weirdness and do away with the whole wave function collapse and everything, you know, it's got a gold star on my book.
Well, I'm sure they'll be glad to hear that. And would you like to make that a new Physics FM prize?
The Gold Star Award?
The Randy Morrison Gold Star Award?
No, I think I wouldn't want to be that presumptuous, but I am glad to give praise where praise is due, so.
I mean, you're sure, because I've got a color printer. I can run down to Office Depot and get some nice paper, and bam.
Oh, come on. You can't go cheap like that. You got to get the real gold stars on the whole, like, wax paper and everything.
Randy, we haven't monetized this podcast.
That's true.
Well, I mean, I'm already out, you know, a couple hundred dollars a year just to keep us going. We can't.
Can't go for the gold stars, too?
If I were running around buying cold foil to put on pieces of paper to send to people, my wife would kill me.
Well, maybe I'll just do away with one of my coffees each month, and I'll, because, you know, we're only going to send out maybe 3 a year, right? Well, Jim, I really appreciate you bringing these papers to my attention, and they were really fascinating to read. I hope that one day we can actually run some experiments in this direction and see if we can test these fascinating ideas. But, you know, I'm really glad that you brought these to my attention. I enjoyed them a lot. Thank you.
Okay, awesome. All right, well, thanks, Randy.
All right, James, you have a great night.
You bet. You too. Bye now.
Bye.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers number 33, Retrocausality. Show notes can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/33. The notes include links to the papers discussed in this program and other bibliographic information, such as recommended books and related shows. Also, you may have noticed that in the 4 months since we recorded this program, we have started monetization. So, if you would like to help out a little bit, show your support at www.patreon.com/frontiers. Any help you can give would be greatly appreciated.